from WBUR Boston. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mitt Romney got a nice welcome in Israel this weekend, making some friends among donors, but it wasn't without a few big bumps along the way.
It's a deeply moving experience to be in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel.
Longtime Texas Republican Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst was knocked out in the Senate primary race. Tea Party favorite Ted Cruz stole the show.
To preserve liberty, to restore the Constitution, I am humbled and honored to be marching alongside each and every one of you.
And U.S. gymnast Gabby Douglas gave a high-flying performance yesterday at the London Olympics, becoming the first African-American to take the women's all-around gold. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Washington Examiner's Byron York, the Philadelphia Inquirer's Trudy Rubin, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What's your eye on this week? Romney in Israel, Obama in Syria, Ted Cruz in Texas, or is it all fun and games at the Olympics for you? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now with the talk from Washington is Byron York, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner and syndicated columnist. Byron York, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Wade. Thanks for having me.
Out on Cape Cod in Wellfleet, Massachusetts, taking time off from her grueling vacation is Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, welcome back.
Hi, Wade. Lovely to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Wade, Byron, and Trudy.
Mitt Romney is back from his six-day, three-country trip. He got off to a rough start, casting aspersions on how well the British had organized their Olympic Games, which annoyed Fleet Street. But then the governor recovered. The Obama administration characterized the trip as a disaster, which is overstating it a bit. But it was not the triumphant international tour that he and his aides were hoping for, was it, Trudy?
It depends on which audience you're talking about. If the audience was evangelicals, whose vote he's courting by trying to be even more pro-Israeli than the prime minister, then, you know, maybe it did some good. And if it's his major donor, Mr. Adelson, who a lot of his donors actually came along with him on the trip, very big donors, then maybe it did him some good. But in terms of casting him as a future foreign policy president and in terms of our relationships in the Middle East, I think it did a lot of harm, boxing himself into positions which, if he really means them, and you always question that when someone's on a campaign trip overseas, it will cause him a lot of problems in the future.
What about with American Jews? I mean, I thought that, an important part of this trip was trying to appeal to America's Jewish community.
The U.S. Jewish vote, the polls show that it's still leaning heavily Democratic, even though the percentages, have decreased, but still a big majority leaning Democratic. I think the more important constituency for him is evangelicals who've been suspicious of his Mormon faith. This trip will gain him a small blip in the Jewish vote. But in fact, President Obama, despite what Romney says and the Republicans say, has been an incredible friend of Israel, with joint military exercises, more military aid. You've had remarks from the Israeli defense minister just recently to that effect about how close the relationship is. So I can't see that this trip is going to make a big difference in the U.S. Jewish vote.
Byron, how do you feel the trip went?
You have to separate the substance of the trip from the coverage of the trip. And the substance of the trip I thought was pretty good. The coverage of the trip was obviously pretty bad. The London is not ready statement that he started out with was a gaffe. It was just a mistake. It was very undiplomatic. I didn't think it was a huge mistake, but it certainly was. In Poland, the goal was to try to show himself that if I am president, show them that if I am president, I am going to be your friend. you feel badly treated by the Obama administration, but I will be your friend. And he associates himself. He gets the endorsement of the founder of the Solidarity Union. So I think they count the Poland part a big plus. And as far as Israel's concerned, a couple of things. One, a lot of American Jews, evangelicals, the conservative group that he was trying to appeal to, I thought they thought he did pretty well. And the Romney campaign feels that they've been pretty badly treated as far as the press is concerned with this whole Palestinian culture remark. They felt Romney was speaking much more broadly and speaking about other countries other than just Israel. The last thing is the one area where he failed pretty spectacularly was in the care and the feeding of his traveling press corps. He went over there and did a bunch of interviews with TV networks, did two with Fox, did two with CNN, did one with ABC, NBC, CBS, did a lot of talking to anchor people. But he didn't talk to his traveling press, and they were unhappy and made their unhappiness known, and that led to some of his problems. He should clearly go back to the back of the plane and chat with some people.
I would really disagree with that. I think that on substance he did really flub, and it had nothing to do with the press corps. First of all, one should note that although Lech Walesa, the famous former head of the Solidarity Union, endorsed Romney, the union Solidarity actually came out against Romney, saying that he had shortchanged workers in the United States and they could not endorse him, which I think was very telling. But secondly, when he came to Israel, the cultural comments were specifically about the Palestinians. There was a correction afterwards to extend it to the rest of the Arab world, which wasn't that helpful either. But what Romney actually said was that Israeli gains were because of cultural differences. Now, this is to take nothing away from the tremendous economic development in Israel, but the Palestinian situation, the economic situation, is directly connected to occupation. There is no way you can have economic development in the West Bank. I have been there many times, the most recently in May, and the Palestinians are the most economically virtuous and talented Arab group in the Middle East. They've proved that over and over again. They have great talent as businessmen. But on the West Bank, it's totally broken up by settlements, by security checks. You can't get goods to market. You can't get things out easily. You can't get your raw materials in easily. People won't invest until there's a political settlement. So while you have a few little blips of growth, you really have a situation in which it's impossible to develop a functional economy, and he totally overlooked that. And I think that he has boxed himself into a situation in which he has basically endorsed a platform where there would be absolutely no more peace process. And he also, and even more so some of his advisors, were boxing themselves into Israel in a situation which might get the United States involved in what I believe would be a dangerous and counterproductive war with Iran.
Jack, it's late July and it's August. I think maybe – I just don't know how much of this was absorbed by the voting public. I mean, maybe a little bit about the gaffe in London, a couple of pictures at the wall. What's your take?
It's very hard to say. I mean, this election isn't going to be decided. It may not even be substantially influenced by foreign policy. What strikes me about this, though, is Mr. Romney's lack of preparation. I mean, I'm not the first one to point out that he seems to do foreign policy on the fly. Even his own people can't quite explain his position on Afghanistan. He made that remark about Russia being our number one geostrategic foe. He seems to not have spent these years reading about or thinking about or thinking through foreign policy positions, and it makes him vulnerable to the last person he spoke to. And in Israel, that seemed to be a man named Dan Senor, who was the the publicity chief or the press secretary of the America of the of our occupation in Iraq, and who is it'd be you know be like listening to your press secretary talk about the cultural differences between two peoples and so on. I mean, the Palestinians reacted to the remark as if it were racist, and a professor quoted in the Jerusalem Post said it sounded to him like it was anti-Semitic, talking about the Jews and their affinity for money. It was the kind of thing that a prepared presidential candidate, he wouldn't make that sort of mistake.
Byron, there has been some sniping from, you know, political consultants inside of the Republican Party, not Romney's political consultants, about the content of Romney's speeches and where he's going. You make anything of it or not much?
Now, are you referring specifically to the foreign trip or his speeches in general?
To the foreign trip and to his speeches in general, I think both. There's, you know, there's a yearning for more meat on the bone, I guess.
Right. I wrote about this today. As far as the foreign speeches are concerned, there's clearly a number of Republicans who felt like he didn't need to make this trip. As a matter of fact, since the general election seems to be going at such a high rate of speed right now at this early date, there was no reason to actually take a week off and go do this. So there's debate inside about that. As far as Romney's stump speech, you saw him go to Colorado yesterday and unveil a revamped stump speech. And the bottom line is people have been complaining that he simply didn't offer enough details about what he would actually do to make the economy better. He's trying to do that now.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about this week's news, and more news. We're talking with Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Trudy Rubin from the Philadelphia Inquirer, and our own Jack Beatty. Yesterday, Mitt Romney was a guest on Sean Hannity's show, Hannity Radio. During the interview, he defended himself against accusations from Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who said an anonymous source from Bain Capital told him Romney had not paid any taxes for 10 years.
Well, it's time for Harry to put up or shut up. Harry's going to have to describe who it is he spoke with, because, of course, that's totally and completely wrong. It's untrue, dishonest, and inaccurate. It's wrong. So I'm looking forward to have Harry reveal his sources, and we'll probably find out it's the White House.
Byron, did Harry Reid single-handedly help give Romney a little momentum on the release your taxes issue?
Well, he certainly did with the Republican base. I mean, what Reid said was off the scale outrageous. He basically said that he had a good source who told him that Romney had paid no taxes for the last 10 years, and that the burden of proof here was on Mitt Romney because it was Harry Reid who was accusing him of doing this. And I think we should posit right now that none of us, I think, knows what Mitt Romney paid in the last 10 years. So the fact is we just don't know. He hasn't released those. He's released his 2010 returns and promises to release his 2011 returns. So Reid has actually doubled down and stuck with this. He released a statement last night in which he repeated this again. And I don't know where this is going to go. The only people I've seen really in the mainstream media who've really condemned Reid for this is Jon Stewart, who made a big deal of it on his show. I don't know where it's going to go. It seems amazing that Reid could actually keep saying this, but so far he seems inclined to.
Jack, if Romney's comments about London's preparation for the Olympics was a head slapper, if I'm in the White House, I'm slapping my head about Reid's comments.
Absolutely. I mean, it is just – it's a smear, and it's – and also it comes – and if I were the administration, I would really distance myself from it, because it's bad business for an incumbent administration to be talking about the taxes of a candidate running, you know, challenger to the sitting president. There is a lot of precedent, and I've been reading about this in the New Deal, where businessmen would criticize the Roosevelt administration and they'd be audited. Lyndon Johnson, there were a raft of charges against him at the IRS, and President Roosevelt said, no, we don't want to do that. In other words, these things have been abused in the past, and the administration should have nothing to do with it. On the other hand, what we know about Romney's returns, we know that he has an IRA worth upward of $100 million. Now, there used to be a legal limit of $6,000 a year on this. How is it that he has this? How did he get that? And is this the kind of loophole that has been draining, you know, money from the Treasury? House Democrats are asking that question now. They're asking the Treasury Department to throw light on it. And it will throw light on Romney's use of the IRA, but also on a big tax loophole.
Trudy, I'm not expecting the IRA to audit Romney anytime soon.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. What makes me laugh is that, of course, there's a way for Romney to respond if he released his tax records, as other candidates have done. It may have been foolish for Reid to put down the gauntlet as he did, but clearly he's challenging Romney. And if what Reid said is untrue, Romney can easily disprove it. And the reason why the public is entitled to see those tax returns is obviously because the $100 million IRA hints at an extensive use of tax loopholes and probably overseas tax shelters, which, while they may technically be legal, and we don't even know if they are, but while they may be, they probably would be very distasteful to the American public at large because they would show a kind of behavior by a super wealthy individual that indicated that he took advantage of the situation and acted in a way that would be distasteful to most Americans. And so put up or shut up, I would think. It's not just Reid, it's Romney. The spotlight is on him.
Let's take a caller. Mark is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hi, Wade.
Hello.
Romney's remark is the most comical thing I've seen since that scene in Blazing Saddles where Cleavon Little is surrounded, puts a gun to his own head and says, throw down your weapons or the sheriff gets it. The problem with your analysis and most of your panel is the calendar. Mitt Romney was the one who started this whole thing. On Sunday, he gave an interview to ABC and said, I paid substantial taxes every year going back to the beginning of my career. It was only after that that Reid made his allegation. And Romney, yesterday, said that Reid's allegation is false. Well, yeah, he can disprove it by producing his tax returns. But you know what? He doesn't want to produce his tax returns. Fine, show us the receipts. Show us the checks. If he paid substantial taxes every year, it's easy. All he's got to do is come up with the checks. And the fact that he won't come up with the checks means that I don't believe him. And I don't think a lot of other people believe him either.
Byron, there is a group, and maybe a growing group of Republicans out there who are asking Romney to release maybe not 10 years, but a few years of his taxes just to make this go away.
Well, there are. As a matter of fact, the last time this came out, and Democrats, including the president himself, have been pushing this pretty hard for quite a while. And the last time it flared up, National Review, the conservative magazine, editorialized calling on Romney to release more of his tax returns. I think Reid's statements make it a little harder for Romney to do that, at least anytime in the next few days or even weeks, because they are so outrageous, they are so slanderous. It's kind of I have good evidence that you are a child molester, and the burden is on you to show me that you are not. This is actually uniting Republicans around Mitt Romney. I've heard more people in the last 24 hours say, nope, never going to release any. He should never release any of them. And they probably feel more strongly that way now that Harry Reid has done this.
How much damage do you think this will do, Romney, as the campaign continues?
Well, Reid's accusation won't do any damage unless there's some fact out there that can be used to back it up. So Reid's won't do any damage, might even help Romney. Now, the Obama campaign is going to keep pushing on this forever and ever. And it's I don't know whether that will do any damage that lasts all the way through November.
We're probably going to be talking about Romney's taxes for some time. Let's switch gears a little bit. On Wednesday in Mansfield, Ohio, President Obama used the results of a study by the Tax Policy Center to attack Mitt Romney's proposed tax plan.
An independent, nonpartisan organization ran all the numbers on Governor Romney's plan. This wasn't my staff. This wasn't something we did. Independent group ran the numbers. They found that if Governor Romney wants to keep his word and pay for this plan, then he'd have to cut tax breaks that middle-class families depend on.
Jack, you know, there is this independent analysis that says you're going to have to cut a lot of tax breaks that the middle class love, interest tax breaks, payroll taxes. What do you make of this new study?
Well, here's a tax issue that I think could really hurt Mr. Romney, and I think he has no one to blame but himself for it. The lack of bones on the policy, the lack of flesh on those bones, rather, that you mentioned, is dramatically true with this issue, with this across the board tax cut that he came out with, I think, just a few months ago. He didn't specify how it was going to be paid for, and that left the way open for the Tax Policy Center, which very inconveniently the Romney campaign called an objective source when it was slamming Rick Perry last fall. It left the way open for them to come up and say, well, okay, how would he pay for it? How could you pay for what this would do to the deficit? And the numbers are devastating. I mean, they couldn't make the numbers work in any way other than that the middle class paid more and the wealthiest got more. That's devastating.
Trudy, this Tax Policy Center study plays in the Democrats' narrative that Romney is a rich guy who's out to help the rich at your expense.
Well, yes, it does. I mean, this is the kind of short-sighted thinking that I think also is reflected in Romney's foreign policy statements. But I don't think it's a gaffe. You know, I don't think that what he said in Israel, for example, had just to do with his briefings by Dan Senior. I think these things speak to deep-held beliefs. When you look at the statements Romney makes, it really seems that he believes the rich are entitled to more because they produce more. And he doesn't seem ashamed of that outlook. I think that's a weapon, a self-inflicted wound, pardon my mixed metaphors, that the Democrats certainly could pick up on, and the figures from this study make sobering reading for middle-class voters who would become aware of them.
Byron, is this a concern at all, or much ado about nothing in your mind?
Well, first of all, Romney has called for, I think, a 20% across-the-board reduction in federal income tax rate, so reduction for everybody. He has not specified a lot of the things about how he would make this revenue neutral. He promises it will be revenue neutral. That is, any revenues lost from tax collections would be gained by the closing of loopholes and things. As Jack suggested, this report is conjecture based on possible ways Romney might do this, but it's not based on any Romney proposal. As a matter of fact, the report begins, quote, "We do not score Governor Romney's plan directly," because there isn't a plan to score. So there's a lot of conjecture in this, and Romney will at some point in the campaign, probably soon, start filling in details, and then we could probably have a more substantive discussion about it.
I think that's true, but I think it's fairly clear economically that the only loopholes that would make a big difference would be loopholes that would hit middle-class taxpayers in the gut, like the interest deduction on mortgages or paying taxes on your health plan. And putting forward this idea without details so far is typical of the way the Romney campaign has gone, but also closing loopholes on the rich if he was really going to attempt that, it would be very embarrassing if he put forward his tax returns, because probably he's been taking full advantage of most of those loopholes.
I mean, in order to tamp this down, Romney is going to have to give some more specifics as to how this would be revenue neutral, and, you know, hopefully those for him, those specifics won't be gutting a lot of tax breaks that the middle class depend on. Let's take another caller. Tom, you're calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hello.
Hello, Wade. I think this is really the story of the week, in the sense that, and the president's picked up on it yesterday. I think they're beginning or getting ready to run ads to the effect that it's going to hit the middle class. And you can highlight it with the Senate passing the 250 and under, which is really a tax break for everyone, not just the rich, because everybody up to 250. It's only income over 250. So a millionaire still gets a tax break under the Senate version. But with Romney, $2,000 for the middle class. I mean, if they can push that, that's devastating in the fall, because that's a tax hike on, what, 90% of America.
Jack?
Well, undoubtedly it is. Now, as Byron says, he can come out now and have a big plan for tax reform. And, you know, people have been saying we need tax reform. We need to plug loopholes. What, I think the latest commission said there was $1 trillion in loopholes and tax expenditures and the like in the tax code. Clear a lot of that out and lower rates. Fine, let's have that discussion. But he should have precluded this by having that discussion before he put out the plan. I mean, it shows this lack of preparation. The man has been running for president for a decade, and he hasn't got this sort of thing wired up properly yet, it seems to me.
Byron, what about connecting the tax cuts to the economy? I mean, the economy is what's driving this political campaign. It's what everyone is concerned about. You know, is a way out of this by connecting these tax cuts to his proposals for improving the economy?
Well, that's what you saw Romney start to do yesterday. As I mentioned before, Romney has been the subject of a lot of questioning from Republicans who said, look, you need to flesh out your plan, and you need to speak in detail on the stump about what you will do to make things better. These concerns were, I think, heightened by this new poll we had earlier from Quinnipiac in the New York Times, which really suggested in the swing states a lot of voters have just given up on the idea that the economy is going to get better. They don't think things are going to get better anytime in the near future, no matter who is elected president, and some of them seem to give the edge to Barack Obama because they think he empathizes more with them. He understands their plight a little more. And Romney's challenge is to say, no, things can get better. This is what we can do, and if we do it, things will improve. And he's starting to do that, and the tax cutting plan, especially like the corporate tax, things like that, that Romney believes, and he does believe, will spur economic growth. He needs to start pushing that.
Well, Trudy, if you look at Europe, there's a lot of reason to be worried about where this economy is headed.
That's true, but could I digress for a second? There is a sleeper in this election. We touched briefly on the Israel trip, but when we're talking about the economy, the last thing that the American public is looking for is another war in the Middle East. When Romney was in Israel, his key advisor, Dan Senor, whom we've mentioned, basically said that the United States would support an independent attack by Israel on Iran, and stories in the Israeli press are saying that an attack could come in the next 3 months before the election. The last thing the American public wants or can afford is another war in the Middle East, and if Israel goes independently, inevitably the U.S. will have to back them and will be affected, because oil prices will skyrocket. We don't know what would happen in the Gulf. The U.S. military doesn't want this. The President Obama doesn't think this is necessary at this point. And so, again, Romney is not thinking through the consequences, as far as I can see. And Dan Senor and many of his advisors are the people who brought us the Iraq war without thinking through the consequences.
All right, Trudy, I'm going to have to interrupt you. I'm sorry. Hold it right there. We got to go to break. Listeners, we're discussing a week's worth of news. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the elegant man of words, Gore Vidal, died Tuesday at 86 of complications of pneumonia. He brought a biting tongue and a sharp mind to American politics and literature.
I believe the government to be of any value must rest upon the people at large and not be the preserve of any elite group or class or anything of a hereditary nature.
Days of power blackouts in India left nearly 700 million, that's 10% of the world's population, in the dark and deeply frustrated.
The whole system was at a standstill. That goes on to show how vulnerable we are. One grid failure and the entire country, North India, was on a standstill.
And Wednesday, on Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day, supporters rallied around the fast food chain amid a debate over its president's opposition to same-sex marriage. Marcos Hernandez in Davie, Florida, lined up in support of the fast food chain.
I want to support the CEO's right to free speech. I don't think it's right that anybody should take any political action against somebody who's just voicing his opinion. And he's just running a business like anybody else in this country.
We're talking with Byron York, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist. She writes the World View column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And On Point's regular, Jack Beatty. On Tuesday night, Tea Party candidate Ted Cruz clinched the Texas Republican Senate nomination. During his victory speech, he told voters they were part of a larger movement.
We are witnessing a great awakening. Millions of Texans, millions of Americans are rising up to reclaim our country, to defend liberty, and to restore the Constitution.
Byron, I covered the Christian Right's takeover of the Republican Party in Texas by simply putting more Christian fannies in the party caucus seats than the country club Republicans, but still the money Republicans were able to control what they wanted the candidates to do through their campaign contributions. But this time, that didn't work.
Well, I think, first of all, reports of the Tea Party's demise are greatly exaggerated. But the biggest reason Ted Cruz did well against almost all of the Republican establishment in Texas is it is a very good candidate. I mean, he's a Princeton, Harvard Law, Solicitor General of Texas, has argued a zillion cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, extremely smart. This guy is a very good candidate, and the hits that the Tea Party took nationally a couple of years ago were with candidates like Christine O'Donnell and Sharon Angle, who would not have been good candidates had there never been a Tea Party. Somebody like Ted Cruz is a very impressive guy, a very good candidate, and he managed to tap in to that unhappiness with establishment Republicanism that you see in the Tea Party, and a guy like that is going to win.
Byron, do you think this is a one-off or a harbinger of things to come inside the Republican Party?
Well, other candidates have done well. Other Tea Party candidates, Richard Murdoch in Indiana, knocking off Richard Lugar, Senator Mike Lee in a couple of years ago in Utah, knocking off Robert Bennett. So this is the Tea Party is becoming more established part of the Republican Party. There's just no doubt about it. The sentiments that are most important to them, mostly fiscal responsibility, have become a major part. And you've got, there were a number of major figures like George Will, National Review, who were on Ted Cruz's side, the Club for Growth. So this is not as if this is just a bunch of scrappy outsiders with chewing gum and duct tape. There's a rising counter-establishment inside the Republican Party.
Jack, David Dewhurst's biggest backer was the governor of Texas, Rick Perry. And the talk now is that the biggest loser in addition to David Dewhurst is the governor, Rick Perry.
Yeah, and he's had redundant losses, hasn't he? I mean, he humiliated himself in the Republican primaries, and now this denouement, it would seem to be the end of him. But, to get back to Mr. Cruz, he must be the only graduate of the Harvard Law School who believes in that a UN document known as Agenda 21 would abolish golf courses and would prevent paved roads. And he has written on his blog that the originator of this grand scheme is none other than George Soros. He must be one of the few Princeton graduates who believes, quote, Sharia law is an enormous problem in the United States. So we don't want to too quickly let his academic background, stellar as it is, excuse him from his conspiratorial worldviews, at least on a couple of these big matters before the country.
Byron, Ted Cruz is going to, if he wins, he'll be the front runner now. If he wins, he'll be replacing Kay Bailey Hutchison, who was a moderate. This will take the Texas delegation in the Senate quite a bit, a strong step to the right.
Right. With the conservative Senator John Cornyn, it makes the Texas delegation more conservative. It makes the Republican caucus more conservative to switch out Hutchinson for Ted Cruz. And so Ted Cruz will join Rand Paul, Mike Lee, Jem DeMint as the sort of really most solid, most conservative wing of an already conservative party.
Let's take a caller. Kathy is calling from Quicksburg, Virginia. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Hello, Wade. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
I've been wanting to call you for the last 2 weeks to say, hey, as a fellow Texan.
Hello.
And I listen to you every time you're on the air, but now I'm kind of embarrassed to be from Texas. It's, you know, it was bad enough that Kay Bailey Hutchison was our senator for so long, and she didn't even come from Texas. This new guy is from Canada, and the Tea Party scares me. I mean, Texas is scary enough with that textbook stuff they were doing, and now they're riding on the coattails of the Tea Party, to me, which is an anarchist bunch of people with some of the same beliefs of Jefferson Davis and the Confederacy.
Jack, does Cruz's if Cruz is elected, does his does this pose any sort of problems or a warning signal to the Republican establishment in Washington?
Well, it's going to make problems for sure for Mitch McConnell. He says not, and he says, I look forward to Mr. Cruz, and I'm sure he does. But we've seen John Boehner, you know, really have to tack considerably to the right to accommodate not just the freshmen, but the conservative study group in the House. And the danger, of course, is that they can sort of put themselves, go so far right that they go off the American mainstream. For example, the day after Cruz won, I guess Tuesday, on Wednesday, the House held a hearing on making English the official language of the country. Now, on the one hand, you have a Cuban-American candidate raised up into the Senate, likely. And on the other hand, you're playing to the nativists, saying we've got to make English the – and there's no protection against that kind of thing within that caucus, because the speaker can't really say to people, hey, listen, I don't want you to do that, because that's going to spoil our chances even more with Hispanic voters. So this kind of problem is just going to keep arising with these extreme candidates.
We had a very interesting display of movement politics this week in and around the Chick-fil-A controversy over the president's support for organizations that are fighting against gay marriage. And you saw gays kind of organize themselves on Facebook, and then you saw conservatives, many of them Christian right, but all kinds of conservatives, also then counter-organize themselves into a Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day. You don't often get to see this kind of grassroots give and take back and forth. What'd you make of it? Jack?
I think this is just proper movement politics, and the mayors were out of line in saying we don't want your business in these cities. They're just scoring political points. Speech is free, but people can go to the marketplace and make their views felt there. And I think that will happen. Marketplace did a report on this last night, and they couldn't get any kind of response out of Chick-fil-A Chick-fil-A Central, as if the Chick-fil-A corporate was beginning to think, well, wait a minute, maybe we will alienate more people than we will attract. Is this really what we want to do with our outspoken CEO losing business for us over the long run? It sounded as if they were giving that some thought.
I'm not sure what Chick-fil-A's management thinking is. I'm not sure they're worried about the backlash. They seem to be okay. Byron, what's your take?
Well, I thought it was a pretty big display of Chick-fil-A values across the country. It was a very impressive turnout. But we have to remember that the issue that started this is, can or should a city deny a business license to a company because the leader of that company says he opposes gay marriage? And I think that's kind of a already dead question now. I think the mayors of Boston and Chicago have been backing off that a bit, and that's I think they've realized that that was a really dumb and pernicious thing to suggest. So I think Chick-fil-A won on that. And after that, it's just an argument about gay marriage, which is kind of a show of force from each side politically.
Tony is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Tony, welcome to the show.
Hello, hello. My point is I'm tired of hearing that this is a free speech argument. It's a gay argument. The same people who were in line saying that he should be able to, that they're standing up for his right to say whatever he likes, were the people who were telling the Dixie Chicks a few years ago to be quiet, you have no right to say that. So let's get this straight. This is a gay argument. The free speech argument is a false argument. Thank you.
Thank you. We have there's news that the president is quietly, or you know, throwing the country's support behind the Syrian Free Army. Trudy, I wondered what, you know, what, if anything, you think this is going to do?
I think quietly is the operative word here. I mean, so far, I don't think the administration has made up its mind. I don't agree with people like Senator McCain and Senator Lieberman who say we should support a no-fly zone because I don't think it would do any good. The battles are in Aleppo and Damascus, and we're not going to, first of all, NATO wouldn't go along, and secondly, we're not going to fly planes over those cities. Sorry. As for quietly supporting the army, what we're doing now, the Free Syrian Army, what we're doing now is we have a few CIA staffers down on the border between Turkey and Syria trying to figure out who's who inside Syria of the various groups and who should be helped with non-lethal aid. I think that process should be intensified. What's happening now is that the money that's going into these fighting groups inside Syria is all coming from the Gulf. It's going to the most Islamist and the most radical Islamist. And that does not bode well for what will happen after Assad falls. I don't think we should get involved in a big way, but I think in a quieter way we could be doing a lot more than we are now to try to identify some military fighters that we can help who are not radical Islamists and facilitating aid getting into them.
Byron, the Governor Romney has been probing for opportunities to get to the right of the president on foreign policy to, you know, to appear tougher. Is this an opportunity here?
Well, I actually personally agree with most everything Trudy said about this. I mean, the issue is the worry is who are these rebels, and they're a kind of a varied group, but there's some really bad actors in them, and that Assad falls and they're all just killing each other, or oppressing each other, killing civilians, bad things happen. And an effort by the United States to find out if there are any good guys that we can support, I think, is a smart idea. The Reuters article that reported this presidential finding that the president signed did say, well, you know, the rebels seem to be more organized lately. They seem to be doing a little better, suggesting that that is perhaps the result of some American assistance. Not clear. We don't even know when the president signed this document. But it's something I think that Romney has got to be very, very careful about, because you do have the McCain-Lindsey Graham faction on one side, which basically wants to go in and do stuff. And I think a no-fly zone would be an act of war, basically. And then you have a lot of others in the Republican Party urging caution on this. So my guess is Romney's cautious instincts will win out.
Last night, Michael Phelps and Ryan Lochte faced each other in the 200-meter medley. Although Phelps won his 20th gold medal last night, he failed to break Lochte's world record for the 200 meters.
Lochte is coming back, but I think it's going to be Phelps. It's Lochte's world record. It's Lochte's world record. And it still is Lochte's world record, but it's gold to Phelps. Finally, he wins gold.
I misspoke. It wasn't his 20th gold medal. It was simply his 20th medal. But I think the big story was Gabby Douglas. Is she in America's new sweetheart after she became the first African-American woman to win the all-around in gymnastics? Jack?
Well, she certainly is a winning personality. 16 years old. The Daily News notes that she now is guaranteed her a spot on a Wheaties box. And she said, "I kind of forgot about that. Man, that's awesome. That's definitely an amazing feeling." And you read about her background, the sacrifices her parents made to contribute to her training, her discipline, her resolve. Quite an impressive story.
Trudy, did you catch her?
Oh yes. And really, I mean, basically, you know, her sister encouraged her when she was going to give up. Her mother, because the father doesn't seem to be in the picture, agreed that she would go to Iowa for training, where she lived for 2 years with a white family. She, as she kept pointing out, was practically the only black person she felt in Iowa. And you had both families, her white foster family while she was going through training, that took care of her pro bono, made her one of their own family, and her mother, sister, and brother. I think the families and the parents are a big part of this story, because when you watch them in the stands, it was almost, not quite, as wonderful as watching someone like Gabby Douglas flying through the air.
Gabby Douglas uniting the country behind her. Byron York, chief political columnist for the Washington Examiner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Dale.
Truby Rubin, foreign affairs correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer, thanks to you, too.
Thank you.
And a big thanks to you, Jack Beatty.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at website onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.